Today on The Grave Talks, Science of the Dead, a conversation with John Kazuka. When your hero passes onto the other side, especially as a child, it is heartbreaking. If you only had one more day, one more hour, one more second to say what you wanted to, it could make the whole thing a little easier to bear. However, that's usually not how it goes. When you're a child, you're still learning what is possible and impossible. So is it really all that impossible when you see your deceased hero walking around the downstairs entry to your home? That's where it all started for John Kazuka, as we hear his story today on The Grave Talks.
Well, I was always kind of that weird kid that liked hearing about ghosts, but it really kicked in actually when I was a kid. My grandfather had passed away. And, you know, after things settled down, my grandma wanted to have me and my brother over there. And we went over there. We slept on the second floor of this older Victorian styled house. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather passed away on the main floor. And to get water, obviously, you had to come downstairs. So you come down six stairs, you hit this flight or landing, and then you have to go down another flight of stairs to get to the kitchen area. And it was late at night. I don't know what time it was. And I was coming down the stairs. I needed water, and I really needed to go to the bathroom because I drank a lot of water. So I came down the first flight of stairs, hit the landing, and I watched my grandfather walk past the bottom of these stairs. And I remember flying down these stairs. I started crying. I mean, the guy was my hero, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he came to every one of my hockey games. He was my rock.
Yeah.
When I got down there, he was gone. So ever since that day, I've been on this mission to find out, was I dreaming? Did I actually see him? You know? And that was kind of really what kicked me into the paranormal.
Yeah. Well, that's what age were you again on that?
Gosh, I must have been about 8.
Wow. So you had this experience and you had to, because your grandpa was already gone, so you knew that. So did you just know instantly that's grandpa's ghost? Or what was going through your 8-year-old mind, if you can recall?
Well, I actually do remember it pretty vividly, because it's one of those life events that, you, as hard as you try to forget some of it, you just can't. What I thought was the whole thing was a dream, and my grandpa never died at all. He looked so real, like it wasn't your cliche white ghost. He looked like my grandfather, full color, everything. So I remember thinking, I mean, did I just dream this? Is he alive? You know, and yeah, that's what made me fly down the stairs crying, because I thought it was a horrible dream.
Sure. I mean, because everything at that age, you know, you're past the early stages, but there's still a lot of new experiences. And sometimes things that you thought were impossible are not so impossible. So maybe that's just another one of those things that was happening, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's just such an interesting time in life to have an experience like that. How did that go? I mean, what was your reaction, you know, with your parents? Did you say anything? How did you handle that?
I did actually tell my mom. It took me a little while to tell my mom when I got home, just because, I mean, who wants to say they saw, you know, your mother's father? I mean, I didn't want to say anything, and I didn't want my brother to freak out or my mom to freak out. But I eventually told her, and she actually, my mom was really cool about everything. She looked at me, she said, that doesn't surprise me. And, you know, my mom always kind of nurtured that side of me, like my wanting to know more about ghosts and bringing home a plethora of ghost books. And, you know, just she really nurtured my curiosities.
Mm-hmm. And that's awesome that they sat there and they weren't, you know, just dismissive of it. What was the reaction in terms of, you know, being a family member? So this would have been the grandpa. So whose dad would that have been?
That would have been my mom's dad. So, I mean, when she said it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I don't know if there was a conversation between her and my stepdad after that.
Mm-hmm.
I did my thing. I had to get ready for a hockey game anyway. And that's literally right when I told her.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I have no idea how it went after that. But yeah, no, my mom was really good. She actually, from that point on, I remember my mom bringing me home just random books about ghosts after that.
Tell me more about, as life progressed and you're getting the ghost books, we probably went through a lot of the same ones, what was available at the time as kids. I mean, tell me what was sparking, what was your interest in it specifically? What sort of answers were you seeking out? What was the interest as a child?
Well, my interest always came back to my grandfather. I always wanted to know if I actually saw him or if I dreamt the whole thing. So I started really looking into these stories. And it was like the more stories I read, the more I believed I saw him versus me dreaming I saw him. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, from my personal account, it was I'm trying to find the right verbiage here to really describe it, but it was kind of surreal. And as I got older and grew, and the more I learned, the more I recognized that the likelihood of me seeing him is more or greater than the likelihood I didn't.
Sure. As you continued on into life and you were getting more and more interested in the paranormal, where did that lead you? I mean, as a child, did you have any other experiences?
No, I mean, I was looking for my grandmother was actually kind of similar to my mom. So, we'd go on trips. I grew up in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, and we go on trips to, British Columbia, like Burnaby, to visit an uncle. And along the way, we'd stop and I'd have to go into these abandoned houses. And she'd always pull over and let me go explore. Mm-hmm. And it really fueled my passion, if that makes any sense.
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, that would be a dream of mine if I had a family member that said, hey, yes, go run up to that abandoned house over there. It was that was like my favorite thing of road trips, because you'd be like, there's one. And the joke was always, that's your house, Dad, or that's your house, Mom. I to this day, if it weren't the fear of being arrested or something and being a single dad, yeah, I would probably do it. I'd be a lot more adventurous in terms of going and stopping and taking a look. When she's 18, the abandoned houses better still be there.
Exactly, right?
Yeah. So you got these interesting experiences and settings and just kind of being drawn into that creepy side of things. As you got older, out of childhood, how did that, did this die down? Did this, did it then come back? Tell me how life was from there on.
Well, I mean, as I got older, I started looking at more of the scientific side of things, like going through school. I mean, I did really well in science. And mm-hmm. I started applying, different scientific probabilities to see, and it just kind of progressed from there. The older I got, the more into things I delved. I was this hockey kid. I mean, my hockey was taking off. My dad really drove me. And, I was that kid that I didn't want to go to Disney World. I wanted to go find a haunted house. Let's go see if there's something in there. Let's apply a scientific approach to this now. Mm-hmm. The first law of thermodynamics is my favorite. It's the basis of the pseudoscience of, paranormal investigation, of course. Mm-hmm. Energy can't be destroyed. It can only be changed, but you can't destroy an energy. It doesn't matter what that energy is. So all those millions of neurons in our brains at the time of our passing, they have to go somewhere, So mm-hmm. I must have been about 13 when I really discovered this first law of thermodynamics. And it just really, really piqued me and really kind of spurred me to take a more scientific approach as opposed to the mindset of a kid, right?
Sure.
Even though I was a kid.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you were taking a more scientific approach, what other things did you start to learn and discover about this world of the paranormal?
Well, I think the biggest thing for me was I started, seeing other people's accounts of it. And I started really delving into things and, discovering things like EMF and how people are doing that and how white noise was used to simulate, let me recant that. How people would use white noise as a form of communication for the other side.
Yeah.
So I always did stuff like that. I remember actually having this black and white TV that my grandmother had given me just so I can go and turn it on and have this white noise going in her basement trying to find my grandfather. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it was things like that. Like I started getting older, I started, you know, experimenting more, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
Where it was, I'd take things that I'd read about and I'd actually, you know, do experiments with them. With you know, a large fail rate, I will add. I mean, sure. Back then, I didn't know what I was doing. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it was things like that.
And that's an interesting one to talk about for a moment, that white noise that we hear, you know, through, you know, ghost boxes or what have you. Why do you think that is? What is it that, why is it that white noise seems to be ways of communications at times for spirits, you know, versus just, you know, radios on and, you know, what is it about the white noise?
Gosh, you know, I really wish I had that answer. That's actually something, it's funny you say that, because that's actually something that's been burning on my mind for years. What is it about this white noise? And it's, I don't know how it becomes this beacon. You know, I don't understand how something from the other side can actually use this white noise to communicate with us. Whether, you know, I'm not going to use the obvious SB7 term, but, mm-hmm. you know, whether I'm using a spirit box or not, whether I'm doing or implementing some other form of white noise, how do they do it? And it's just, I can't come up with anything. All I know is it works.
Yeah.
And it works well.
And what about this? This is a question I have for you being an investigator out there. Having white noise, I mean, if you have a dial on your radio, which everyone does, you could find a radio station on the AM band that is strictly static.
Absolutely.
And it's just because there's nothing there. What's the difference between just sticking on the static band and trying to communicate that way versus scanning this, you know, in great succession?
Well, the thing is, it's a frequency thing. Mm-hmm. So you can leave it on one station, but you have minimal success chances that way, because you're putting all your eggs in one basket.
Okay.
Whereas when you turn on, we'll use your spirit box, for example. Mm-hmm. When you pop your spirit box on, it's sweeping through multiple stations.
Sure.
So all that white noise. So you have a greater hit risk. I mean, it's kind of like playing the lottery, right? The more times you buy a ticket, the greater your chances to win the lottery.
Okay.
So applying that same thought process, the more channels you have access to and you're sweeping through, mm-hmm. the greater the chances you're going to have versus just leaving it on, say, 88.1.
Well, is that saying that, you know, when you sweep through, you're just, that's why you're really kind of catching one word or two at a time, because you're just maybe picking up a piece of the sentence that they're trying to say, because you got to that frequency and then you're off that frequency.
Absolutely. That's absolutely what I'm saying. And I found that you don't get full sentences because you're sweeping.
Yeah. Well, what about this idea? What if there was some way, and I'm sure this really could be done, it would be complicated, but it could be done relatively inexpensively. If you had literally however many radios it would take to make up the whole band of, you want to do AM or FM, have them all going at once and all recording simultaneously on their individual bands.
That is a phenomenal idea, actually.
Yeah.
That's phenomenal.
Then, and you'd have to sift through all of it, but I mean, if you're running, I mean, you can tell waveforms sometimes, but usually, you know, sometimes these aren't the easiest to see just looking at the waveform itself. That would be interesting, because I think that might be a way to get the full sentence if this is, you know, working the way we think it is.
Absolutely. You know what, Tony? What I'm going to do now, because you've totally just lit a fire under my butt, is I will definitely go and run that experiment for you when we're filming one of our shows.
That would be very interesting. I mean, they take a lot of radios, but I suppose...
It definitely would, but I mean, they're radios, man. You can go to a secondhand store and pick them up cheap enough.
You could probably do that. You could probably buy just like bulk, you know, receivers on eBay or something. And it probably would be, yeah, there's got to be a way to do it in bulk fairly easily. It's just the hookup and all of that would be more complicated. But
it would be, but you know what? It's worth it. I'll definitely sit there and figure it out now.
Maybe
I'm totally going to use that idea.
We might have just invented a whole new piece of equipment.
There you go. We'll name it after you. It's the Tony method.
Cool. That's great. Well, there you go. If it works, you have to let me know because we have it documented here on the show. We always come with
we'll definitely do that for you.
I don't know what it is. When we're on the air, there's so many times either it's me and a guest or me and my co-host on our other show where it's like, that's a great idea. Someone should steal that. I don't know what that is.
See, because I'm Canadian, I have to be all polite and stuff. So there's no way I could theoretically steal it. I'd have to go and, you know, I got this idea from Tony. And it happened during, you know, an interview I did with him. So thanks, Tony.
So do Canadians like resent that they're always nice to everybody? Or is it just like, this is cool. This is who we are.
Right. I don't know, man. I grew up this way. So I, you know, it's maybe like, if I...
There's not like some deep darkness down inside where you say, oh, hey, how you doing when you're at the grocery store? And deep down, you're like, I fucking hate you.
You know what I always say is we're like, as people, we're nice, you know, courteous people until you put us in some skates and give us a stick. Then we turn evil for some reason. It's weird.
The demeanor of Canadians is very similar to Wisconsin. So I get it. I understand that mindset. Because I have a lot of friends when we visit up there that's always like, what's up with the people here? It's like, they're just nice. It's kind of how they act. I don't know.
It's something else, man. I'll tell you though, like filming across Canada, I love it because of that, right? Like, you go somewhere and I mean, people are genuinely nice to you, not because you have a camera around you. I mean, we walk around, obviously the cameras aren't following us unless we're in front of the cameras, but no, everyone's really cool up here. It's you know.
So tell me about, as you wanted to start getting investigating and you're looking at this from a more scientific perspective, what kind of things did you want to start looking into? Was it looking at just trying to do the scientific thing, see what works, see what doesn't, and kind of be a resource of, you know, material or scientific tools? You know, was it to get out there and help people individually? Was it just to get out and check out spooky things? How did that begin for you when you were kind of starting to take this on a more serious level?
I think it was kind of a combination of all of them. I actually remember when I was probably about 17, I remember putting, you know, just an ad in our local little paper thing in my area of Winnipeg saying, you know, do you think you have a ghost? I'll come check it out. And it's just something I started doing. And I genuinely wanted to help people and satisfy my curiosity, but I also wanted to apply some of my theories, see if any of my tests will work. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was kind of a combination of those three things, I think, for me personally. And again, it was a very high fail rate. You know, I have a man enough to admit that, you know, I had a pretty high fail rate. Some ideas that I thought were okay, but really weren't. And, you know, but I did get some weird success things back then, too.
Tell me about some of those early on things that were failures and things that were successes and things that were surprises.
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think of one because now you're asking me to go back a long time. let's see. Okay, so because I'm Canadian, I remember I went and brought this hockey puck and set it down in the middle of a kitchen. Mm-hmm. Well, hockey puck isn't going to slide on a kitchen floor. I mean, it really doesn't do that. I mean, it slides best on ice. Mm-hmm. And I should have known that, but I used that as a trigger object. So that was one of my fail safes. That's a total shout out to Canada, too, by the way, just saying. I love you, Canada.
Wouldn't that be interesting though if you did it on ice today? If you know you found a way to like just you know have the hockey puck sitting on you know a little like a large tray of ice, so it could be moved relatively easily. But then I guess you could have the issue though too. The ice will slowly melt, and that will naturally you know shift the puck though too.
Absolutely, it's yeah.
It'd be a hard
it's
one.
Things like that.
Yeah.
Totally things like that. I remember one of the things I did that actually was successful was I had this ball, and this is when I really discovered trigger objects. Mm-hmm. So I remember going into this apartment building, and this lady, I guess, had contacted me. And by this time, I was doing this with a buddy of mine in Winnipeg, and, you know, the two of us were kind of into this stuff. So I brought this ball, this little tennis ball. Mm-hmm. And I set it down and we made sure that it wasn't going to roll. It was on an even, you know, even floor. There was no wind. We did it literally in the middle of our living room, so there was no cross breezes. We ruled all that stuff out. And about an hour into it, this ball rolled about 3 inches. And I was like, wow. And that was the only time it rolled. So that's kind of when I discovered these trigger objects, and I was just blown away. It's like, wow, that actually just happened. Yeah. And that kind of launched me into my current love. I mean, to this day, Poltergeist is like my favorite thing ever. Not the movie, but mm-hmm. the actual activity.
Yeah.
I love Poltergeist activity. There's just something about it.
And I want to talk about that in a minute. I want to talk about the trigger objects first, though. When we're talking about a trigger object, are we talking about something that is simply just there that can be manipulated, like a ball or a light or something of that nature? Or is a trigger object more something that the individual or the ghost that you're trying to communicate with would be more familiar with because it's, you know, a piece of what life was, you know, what the objects were in their lifetime?
Right. I think it's a combination of both of those, actually, Tony. So, you know, you obviously want to, let's say you're in a place where it's rumored to have the ghost, I hate the word ghost, but the entity of a child, we'll say, you know, you want to bring this teddy bear or this ball because you knew kids played. It's a natural response for a kid to play. So you want to bring that and it would be something familiar to them, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a combination. I mean, you look back decades upon decades and teddy bears are a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, stuffed animals were a thing.
Sure.
So it's definitely something that they in that era would have, you know, seen. So you want that physical contact, but it's also something that they would recognize and want to play with.
So having that in that sort of a setting makes a lot more sense. Let me ask you this, because this is one I'm always kind of interested about. When we're putting trigger objects out there, and sometimes it's like a REM pod or something, or whatever it may be, and someone goes, light up the blue one, you know, light up the blue light. You know, yeah. If you said that to me and I'm alive and I'm next to it, I'd be like, how the hell am I supposed to light up the blue light? I don't think they necessarily get like suddenly you're like an expert at electronics when you're dead, but I think I would be very confused. Like, I don't know, have me like move a ball. Like, why am I like going into this electronic device and manipulating lights and shit?
I hear you, man. I know. I'm very careful that way too. Like, you do have to keep, it's kind of like you say, I mean, they don't know how to make it light up. So I always offer to show them how it's done first. It's
sure.
Can you make that light up? I don't ask for a specific color first or right away. It's, can you light that up? So we'll use the REM pod, for example. You know, as you're aware, REM pods have 4 lights on them. Mm-hmm. Our REM pods through our sponsor has 4 lights and it has a temperature gauge. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I always demonstrate, do you want me to show you how to do this? Mm-hmm. You know, and then I'll go up and I'll show them how you have to touch the rod and kind of things like that. And if they start responding that way, it's, can you do that again? Can you make that go red?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, that makes sense. I like that. And that's something, you know, I guess I didn't really even think of, but as much as I'm like pro treat them like people, that's, you know, you just kind of like think sometimes like, we'll set this out or they'll know what they're doing. It's like, what, why would they? Like, no, they won't. Yeah. That's interesting. That's interesting. Let's talk about poltergeist activity a little bit. How would you define what it is? If you had to explain it, what it is and what the source is too.
Well, poltergeist activity is a high amount of mass energy, or so is the belief. It's typically manifested around teenagers. Mm-hmm. Whether it's an output of the teenager's energy, which is the common belief, or not, I've yet to discover myself. But poltergeist activity, I will rule just in terms of being able to move things. If you're able to lift something and throw it, I will consider that a form of poltergeist activity. Mm-hmm. You know, not specifically a poltergeist. That's two different things, but the activity associated with poltergeists. So that's typically what it would be. So it'd be a large mass of energy, strong enough to manipulate physical objects in a lesser form of manifestation.
Well, let's break this down even further, too. Poltergeist activity versus poltergeist. Let's talk about the activity end of things first. So when it's activity, does that not always necessarily need to be connected to a poltergeist?
No, not necessarily. Okay. Now, when I use the term poltergeist activity, what I'm describing is physical movements.
Okay.
You know, anytime a ball can be rolled several inches or thrown, you know, if it's a roll, I'm not really going to call it that because it's not really strong, but
yeah.
I kind of use the poltergeist activity term as a broad spectrum versus an isolated incident, right?
Now, would this be almost like the example that I have in my mind on this would be it's like Pong. For those of you who remember Pong, would it be kind of like essentially the ball in Pong is just this energy, and it's just kind of and the paddles are the people, and if you hit the ball, it kind of goes out. Is that like where we're talking about teenagers, all the energy and things like that, where it just kind of expelled, not consciously, but boom, you get this. And then that energy is kind of bouncing around the atmosphere, and that's where suddenly the vase tips over on the shelf by itself or whatever it may be. Not necessarily like a ghost or something that's over there going, I'm going to knock this shit down. It's just boom. It's the energy that hits it. Would that be a good example?
That's a fairly good example, I'd say. A lot of documented cases are, again, centralized around teenagers going through puberty.
Yeah.
And I mean, you and I remember what that was like. That was just a nightmare.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, you factor in all those crazy emotions and, you know, everything you're going through. And yeah, man, you can put out some crazy energy. And that's typically where poltergeist comes from.
And then it slows down. So what would be a poltergeist then? How would you define that?
A poltergeist would be just that. So it comes from the German language, and it does mean noisy spirit. So poltergeist is, for example, you know, a lot of banging, doors swinging open, you know, things of that nature. And it happens on, you know, I wouldn't say a regular basis per se, but an infrequent basis for an isolated period of time and then just stops.
So is poltergeist a term that really more so describes the demeanor of a spirit? Just like as one, you know, in life, one would go, that's a nice person over there. They're opening the door for the old lady. They're feeding people at the soup kitchen, and they're just all around a good person. And over there, that's an asshole. They're pushing old people into traffic and poisoning the soup at the soup kitchen. So just like how we label the demeanor of a ghost, like, it's not very active, but if you're a super active ghost and you're knocking shit over, that's what a poltergeist really would be, right?
Essentially, yeah.
Okay.
Essentially.
Are we assuming that that this is a once living human that is doing these things?
Well, see, now that's where it kind of skews.
Okay.
I've only been part of two investigations, unfortunately. Now, I say that because I don't want this to ever happen to people, because I mean, my job's to help them. Mm-hmm. But I've only been on two investigations, and I found no supporting evidence of it actually being a conscious being versus just something with a crazy amount of energy. So
really,
I can't actually answer whether that was somebody once living or that was somebody that was manifested.
Meaning something that was created with the energy that's out there.
That's right.
Okay. And then when you have something like that, is that conscious? Is that, I mean, what is the will of something like that?
Well, see, and that's kind of it. That's why I love it so much, because I really don't have that answer yet.
Yeah.
And it's an answer that I want to get so bad. Like, you know, I remember bringing out my spirit box and it didn't bring out anything, you know, but we all witnessed it, like me and my wife, my producer. We witnessed this light, I guess it was a light shade, you know, come up and arc. Like, it wasn't just pushed, it was thrown.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just insane. Like, you know, yeah, man. I don't know how to really answer that properly.
Yeah, I mean, because it almost like creates another category of, you know,
totally
ghost family tree. Because, I mean, I kind of break it down like there's, you know, positive good things that may not have been living. There's dead people that were here. And then there's dark demonic type things that were not good. And then this, but this whole thing is like, this is this concept of we've somehow created this conscious energy with the, you know, the combination of all this different energy. What the hell is that? I mean, that, because that's like, well, what camp do you go to? Or are you just kind of your own thing? Is that like neutral?
Yeah. You know, that's exactly it, right? Like, why, what, how, you know, all these questions.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with John Kazuka. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.